according to the website itself, he said, throwing the third switch, which he had forgotten to throw. These things happen. But also by going to a wide variety of smartphone internet platforms, things like TuneIn Radio, where we are fairly popular, things like Stitcher, the Stitcher app, or Tuner Internet Radio. We're also available at dar.fm and streama.com, and, well, you can get the podcasts over at iTunes, but who goes there anymore? Right? Right. I'm happy to announce that Shirley's challenge got finished off earlier in the day. Thank you very, very kindly. So that leaves us with a clean slate for this evening and the simple task ahead. Oh, simple, he said. Of trying to find 15 folks at 10 bucks apiece, or, you know, two at 75, right, three at 50. Don't make me do the math. To meet this evening's fundraising goal. If you have a hard time getting to the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com, you can always simply use the email address to which it is tied, which is Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid at gmail.com. That's the Horn PayPal email address. Merely select personal and gift, and you can forego the transfer fees that attach to this sort of, to your contribution. Because after all, you're not buying anything, are you? No, this is a collective, cooperative effort. That is what separates us from, say, National Petroleum Radio, who pretends at being public, but is in fact largely financed by people who make things that make brown people go boom. Right? Not that I'm gooning on them. They do some good work. They're a journalism outfit. We're not. We're a conversation outfit. And as it turns out, that's a pretty rare daggum thing these days, being a conversation outfit. So, here we are. Thorn in the Side Thursday. And, this is a veritable rosebush of thorns this Thursday. Good gracious, where to start? Thank you, Isaac. Fix your audio, Bob. How did you know my audio wasn't fixed? I hadn't thrown the third switch. Isaac, are you like magic or something? Wow, that's pretty cool. Or was I just overdue? That's possible, too. A reminder for getting involved in the program later on. Direct dial landline phone number is 304-658-3333. And that'll get you in the queue. If you tried last night and didn't get through, try again tonight. Everybody gets their shot sooner or later. 304-658-3333 gets you into the program, as does Skype, with which we have had monumental success. I only found out from our good friend John earlier in the evening. John is a supporter of the program. He sent a note along saying, have there not been any podcasts the last few days? And looked up, and lo and behold, no, there hadn't. It turned out there had been some technical difficulties at the streaming home office, and Ben Birch will be getting both Monday's show, the Skype-a-palooza, and or New Year's Skype and Eve, or whatever we care to call it. It'll be going up on the website, and you'll be able to hear, those of you who didn't, how much fun we had that evening. And we will. There are conversations ongoing about how to make this a more effective tool going into the future. A little program note for you before we get into this rose bed of wicked, nasty thorns in the side, Thursday thorns. I'll be hitting the road on Sunday the 13th. Of January to go to Washington, D.C., among other things. A memorial is scheduled for our very, very dear friend, Joan Mulhern, senior counsel at Earth Justice, who passed away just before the year ended. Much sadness attended her passing. She was a dear friend and a great friend to Appalachia. So Earth Justice is hosting a memorial service in her memory in Washington, D.C. Ferg and I are founding members of the AHCE team, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Team, who's Joan was integral in helping to create the AHCE bill, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, which you can learn about at aheact.org. Whole new website redesign on the way, by the way, that I think you're going to really like as we move toward a reintroduction. So we'll be going up on the 13th. And since I'm going to also be in Washington, D.C. for the Families USA Radio Row on January 31st, there's every possibility that we will just stay there the entire time. But don't, fear not. I'm going to take the rig with me, and we will broadcast from there. So that, you know, there will not be any vast stretches of no radio time. Now, it's possible there won't be shows, like the 14th. I know there won't be one on the 15th, but maybe not the 14th either. Hard to say. We'll play it by ear, but I did want to let you know that there's going to be some road travel coming up. And that, you know, that could stretch it into probably like coming home on the 3rd or 4th of February. Depending on how things shake out. Like I said, it is Thorn in the Side Thursday, and we've got some genuine dumber in a bag of hammer handles stupid for you from the right wing. You know that picture that's out there? The one that's been around since the Bush administration? The one that was taken of the guy in his short pants with his Cardinals t-shirt on and his do-rag, and he was there to counter-protest against the protest of the war at some war materials manufacturing plant in the St. Louis area, and he's holding up that sign that says, "Get a Brain, Morans." That's where the name for Moran Monday comes from. It's from the fact that these idiotic right-wingers are decidedly challenged where spelling is concerned. Well, we have a new one for the second decade of the 21st century, and I tried real hard on the Twitter and the Facebook earlier today to get this thing to stick. You know, chain-smoking, Merlot-sodden megalomaniac got reelected Speaker of the House today, so that kind of gives you a little sense of, beware of people who breathlessly on the radio declare that they know something is true, because sometimes it ain't. You know, me, if I'm making a prediction, I generally haul out the tattered purple velvet robe with the frayed applique, moons and stars on the sleeves, and the cracked eight ball with the message on the bottom that always reads, "Answer Hazy, ask again later." That's what I use for my prognosticating, but, you know, not always. Everybody doesn't do that. But anyway, the chain-smoking, Merlot-sodden megalomaniac was reelected Speaker of the House today by a margin that really, well, he can't be feeling really good about, because he won 220 to 195. That's all the Democrats voting against him, and some of the repig-lickens, some of the real weirdos, you know. Right? Right. So, we've got him, and part of the anger at him, beyond the screw job that he did on New Jersey and New York and the places that were hammered in, just hammered by Sandy. I can't call it Superstorm Sandy because it sounds like something that needs a for-profit media font and a special graphic and specially composed synthesizer theme music. No, I can't do that. We'll just call it Sandy. Because that's probably enough to remind people of the devastation. But anyway, after he stuck the shiv in New York and New Jersey in a fit of political pique against his chief lieutenant, Eric Lean and Hungry Look Cantor, Leave Brittany Alone. I guess that meme's kind of disappeared a little bit. I explained where the Leave Brittany Alone part comes from on Facebook last night. So, Darcy wrote and said, where's that come from? And so I sent the link, and I hadn't watched the Leave Brittany Alone video in a very long time. Leave Brittany Alone! Oh! I can just hear Eric Cantor saying that. Leave me alone! Back when he was ditching integral House of Representatives work so as to go to the Britney Spears concert at the Verizon Center in Washington, D.C. Yeah. Anyway, the chain-smoking, Merlot-swilling megalomaniac will be Speaker for a couple more years. And the effing is already underway. You know how he said that they'd get right on that Sandy relief? Yeah, not so much. The 113th Congress is now underway. Millions of American women are at hazard because of the absence of the Violence Against Women Act. And yeah, I did find out, Eric Cantor did not like the fact that it empowered tribal peoples to prosecute non-tribal peoples on for domestic violence on tribal lands. Yeah, that was really under his skin. But the other thing is, the Violence Against Women Act had been expanded to offer care to trans people. A segment of our society that probably has a higher suicide rate and a higher abuse rate than any other segment of the population. You know, cross-dressers, transvestites, transsexuals, gender dysphoric. There's a million different names for it, pre-op, post-op. But what most often can be said of them is that they live their entire lives at risk and are frequently beaten, whether it be in bars, their own homes, or even in police stations. Yeah, there was a part of the Violence Against Women Act that included trans people. And Eric Cantor couldn't tolerate that. Because, you know, unless we're talking about guys wearing shocking hot pink yarmulkes and little black dresses and Prada shoes, we can't be having men walking around in the raiment of women's, right? So with all that floating around out there undone, you want to guess what the brand new, slightly less partisan, hope for the future 113th House of Representatives did today? You probably already know this. It was high noon. Yeah, I don't whistle real good. And that's not even high noon, that's Clint Eastwood. Wah, wah, wah. It was high noon when 1L Michelle Bachmann strode proudly to the front of the house, I guess, or maybe to some nondescript office in some building of the Capitol. I really don't know where it is. but the Republicans got busy. It was high noon when 1L Michelle Bachmann tendered the Sandy relief. No, she didn't do that. It was high noon when 1L Michelle Bachmann tendered the reauthorization of the violence against women. No, that wasn't it either. No, it was high noon when 1L Michelle Bachmann, her brains filled with strange little voices and the songs of angels and screeches of demons, and things trying to claw past spider webs and over and around various and sundry rocks within the thin gray settlings that slosh around between her ears that pass for brains in 1L Michelle Bachmann, former tax lawyer, former government worker. It was high noon when she handed over to the clerk of the House a bill to repeal Obamacare. Really? They did that 33 times in the last Congress, I think. And 1L Michelle, squealing, "Ooh, me first! I get to go first! I ran for president! Me first!" gave us probably the most tellingly obvious symbol for this brand spanking new Congress that we could have hoped against. What, you thought they'd changed? You thought that being sternly admonished by people like Peter King and Governor Christie of New Jersey was going to stop making these two-legged freaks of nature stop being two-legged freaks of nature? You didn't really think that, did you? I didn't. I'm pretty sure we didn't. We're reality-based here at the Horn family, are we not? Meet the new boss. Same as the old boss. Aye. And 1L Michelle did that, I think, as a means of, I don't know, keeping her spell check challenged pals in the teabagger nation somehow happy. Are they ever happy? But she did. Gonna reveal that Kenyan Muslim, fascist, communist, socialist, anti-colonialist, deep-seated hatred of white people, Obamacare. Gonna repeal it! And so, 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 years from now, when either future humanity or some race from the stars or maybe some rapidly evolved sentient 6-foot-tall cockroaches go sifting through the detritus of our existence, they will find that in 2013, once they pieced the history together, knowing that we were facing any number of significant problems, maybe by then they will have learned about the Titanic. And maybe they will understand Titanic analogies by then. And maybe then they will understand that with a gaping hole torn in the hull of the ship, 1L Michelle Bachmann was running around the Lido deck saying, No, the deck chairs are arranged all wrong. I'm not sure we even... Can we afford deck chairs? But she had to make the teabaggers happy. And this goes back to, really, I don't just wander off into the weeds. I can find my way back onto the path. Really, this... She had to keep the teabaggers happy because, as I mentioned at the beginning, or sort of the beginning, we've got a new phrase. We've got some new teabaggy words. They come to us from theteaparty.net, which is different from Tea Party, which is different from Tea Party Nation, which is different from People's Front of Judea, splitters! Right. TheTeaParty.net has a leader by the name of Dustin Stockton, whom the story over at The Daily Beast, go figure, describes as a Texas and Nevada-based operative, you know, on odd days. And when you're the head of the TeaParty.net, aren't they all odd days? On odd days, he's a Texas-based operative, and on odder days, he's a Nevada-based operative. But they're all odd days. He was full of fulminating anger at John Boehner and the members of the House Republican Caucus who had voted for that compromise that really wasn't much of a compromise, but did at least manage to keep unemployment benefits going for another year until such things are again held hostage pursuant to the whims of people who use human flesh and bones for their own amusement, you know, the Repiglicans. No, Dustin Stockton, Texas and Nevada-based operative for theteaparty.net. I mean, I don't want them suing me or anything, because they're a weird bunch. Dustin Stockton got all mad at those 85 Republicans who not very excitedly followed the lead of leader Boehner and passed the compromise bill in the House. Because, see, the TeaParty.net wants it all to burn down because, you know, live free or don't tread on me. See how it's so patriotic, how it rhymes that way? Live free or don't tread on me or something. There's snakes involved, I think. But somebody, and God knows why, asked Dustin Stockton, Texas and Nevada-based operative for theteaparty.net, whatever he would do, what was to be done about those 85 traitorous Republicans who decided not to let a couple of million people on unemployment just starve. Starve! Said Pastor John Hagee. And he had an answer, Dustin Stockton did. Like I said, this is the second decade of the 21st century's answer to morons. It's a pity we don't have audio. It's damn near a crime that we don't have audio. Because there needs to be a picture of the morons guy from the first decade of the 21st century with this audio linked under it, just so we can get the whole... Right. But there isn't. But it's out there, and it's in print. Electronic, but in print. And said, we now have 85 members of the House who have shunned their noses at us. It really. I read that fairly early today, and I have been trying to figure out nose shunning ever since. I am, I confess, flummoxed. Shunning? Really? That nose shunning? Is that what they do to you in an Amish community if you trim up your mustache or something and you actually accidentally get one of those little painful hairs that sit on top of the trigeminal nerve? Ow! Nose shunning. We now have 85 members of the House who have shunned their noses at us. Who knew? I've been calling them booger eaters for a long time, but I mean, really. I mean, this conjured up all kinds of stuff for me. Shakespeare, for God's sakes. Romeo and Juliet. Capulets and Montagues. This is quite possibly one of the most well-read, erudite audiences. On the internet or on terrestrial radio. So you probably already know where I'm going. But it's Act One, Scene One of Romeo and Juliet. You know, I said last night that I had added take a picture of Eric Cantor to the liver and spittle, or wherever it is in near the globe where Shakespeare did his tankard of ale drinking via the time machine that I hope someday to have built. Yeah, you call me if you've got one. We got a lot of work to do. And you know, so I could show him the picture of, hey Bill, what do you think of this guy? He has a lean and hungry look. Wait a minute, I'm going to use that. Yeah, well, we got more work for Mr. Shakespeare. Romeo and Juliet, Act 1, Scene 1. There's some witty banter between Gregory and Samson. Sort of needling each other. My naked weapon is out. Quarrel, I will back thee. Gregory, how? Turn thy back and run. Samson, fear me not. Gregory, no, Mary, I fear thee. And then seeing some, who are they? Yeah, they see some Montagues going by. And he says, Gregory says, I will frown as I pass by, and let them take it as they list. And Samson says, nay, as they dare, I will bite my thumb at them, which is a disgrace to them if they bear it. At which point, Abraham and Balthazar, damnedest names for Italians I've ever heard coming from, but, you know, it's Shakespeare, so who knows. And Abraham says, do you bite your thumb at us, sir? And Samson says, I do bite my thumb, sir. Do you bite your thumb at us, sir? Samson, aside to Gregory, is the law of our side if I say I? Gregory, no. No, sir, I do not bite my thumb at you, sir, but I bite my thumb, sir. Do you quarrel, sir? Quarrel, sir? No, sir. You see, they're all under a ban because the prince or noble expositor or whatever he is of Verona has said that there will be no more fighting amongst these Capulets and Montagues because it's become a problem. Imagine if they'd had firearms. Can you imagine the National Rifle Association in, you know, Verona? Well, the way to solve the problems between the Capulets and the Montagues is to give them all big guns! Because the only way to stop a bad Montague with a gun is a good Capulet with a gun. History's full of those little examples, and so is theater. But I immediately thought of that. Do you shun your nose at us, sir? I do shun my nose, sir. Do you shun your nose at us, sir? Is the law on our side if I say aye? No. No, sir, I do not shun my nose at you, sir, but I shun my nose, sir. Well, bully for you, because I didn't know it could be done. See, it changes the whole tenor and character of, of the opening scene. Michael, by email, I give that Moran two shuns up. That's early toaster material, Michael. Eighty-five Republicans have shunned their noses at us. Somewhere out there. Are you with us tonight, Dr. John? Professional word knowers are alternating between weeping and laughing maniacally. They have shunned their nose at us. And then there's the grammar moment. We do have to give them points for grammar. We now have 85 members of the House who have shunned their noses at us. So at least we understand that the 85 members of the House have 85 noses to shun. Everybody, 1, 2, 3. 85 noses to shun on the wall, 85 noses to shun. You take one down, the son of a gun. 84 noses to shun on the wall. No, it doesn't work either, does it? You see the problem this has created? Yeah. Do you shun your nose at us, sir? Do shun my nose. But that's by no means the end of this here Thorn in the Side Thursday. Oh, no. Hell no. I was reminded last night, right after showtime, of a story that hadn't quite made it out of the stack. Our buddy Michael, one of our Michaels, different Michael from the one who wrote earlier, Mike said, Bob, you just missed one of the most insane things I think I've ever seen on TV. A guest host on Anderson Cooper 360 was interviewing Glenn Grothman, a state senator from Wisconsin, who is on a crusade to attack Kwanzaa and, quote, slap it down once and for all because it is a fake holiday founded by a Marxist as an attack on Christianity. This guy, who is a member of the state senate of Wisconsin, also insists on keeping his office open on MLK Day. I thought the guest host, whose name I did not catch, Mike says I'm not a regular CNN viewer, and Roland Martin, did a good job dealing with his insanity. You should try to find the clip if you can. I couldn't find the clip. If any of you do, by all means, let's share it. And when they asked the crazy man, Glenn Grothman, how he felt about Columbus Day, and how you get from Kwanzaa to Columbus Day is a trip I'm just not willing to take. Glenn Grothman, Mike says, insisted that Columbus was a peaceful man who, and Mike included quotation marks here, and I know that Mike knows how to use quotation marks. Columbus was a peaceful man who, quote, founded America, unquote. Oh, my God, says Mike. I can't help but think this is either a great ending to prayer meeting Wednesday or maybe an early nominee for more Ann Monday. And I said, but no, tomorrow, Mike, is thorn in the side Thursday, and this will go perfectly there. Little knowing, of course, that by the beginning of the day, we would have, what's his name, Dangerfield Stockton? No, Dustin Stockton, telling us about 85 members of the House of Representatives who have shunned their noses at theteaparty.net. You got to have the in there. It won't take you where you need to go. Now, if you want to find those geniuses on the Twitter, they are at theteaparty_net. If they're not all covered up in people shunning their noses at them at this point in time. That can quickly crash a Twitter feed, getting all those noses shunned at you. The hell was he thinking? All day long, I mean, because, you know, I know a lot of words. Not that I'm bragging or anything, so do you. What was he thinking? I mean, okay, thumbed their nose. You know, that's kind of like biting your thumb. I mean, if you keep going from the from the upper teeth and you flick the end of your nose, yeah, I can see how that would be insulting. To thumb one's nose. But where did he get shunned? Was this one of the? Was he torn between the feeling of loss and alienation and some sort of existential angst that he felt over the fact that the 85 members of the Republican side of the House had decided not to burn the country to the ground and send 2 million unemployed people into starvation? Was that what made him feel shunned? After all we've done for you, we gave you this Congress in 2010 and now you shunned your noses at us. Please don't let this one be forgotten. Please let this one have the same staying power, although there's no visual to go with it, I understand. Please let this one have the same staying power as Moran's. Because, I tell you, it doesn't happen every day. Granted, there were a lot of signs during the heyday of baggerism in 2010. Lots of misspells. Lots of unintended irony, like keep your government hands off my Medicare. But you're not going to get they shunned their noses at us just every day, because that takes a special breed of, you know, moron to come up with. Michael, meanwhile, is hard at work on that toaster. More shuns. 85 members shunned their noses. The others merely twiddled their shuns. Come on. Work with it. You're not going to run across rich fields like this just every damn day. Marty noting, sorry, I wrecked Doc's DeLorean last week. I left on some train tracks near Eastwood Ravine. Well, there goes that time machine. Of course, there's a Costco over by Manassas, Virginia, probably in the line of march of some one or the other of the two armies that clashed there that we couldn't tolerate, protecting, so they built a Costco on it. And I hear that somewhere back near the law school there's a time machine. You're right. I mean, this begs for a full script word. Shut. I mean, this is Barney Fife stuff. This is gold, unalloyed, 24 karat stuff. Barney, what was the Emancipation Proclamation? That was a proclamation of emancipation. And see, it's causing the same sort of linguistic consternation to Michael that it has for me all day long. He's trying to sort it out. The 85 cut off their faces to shun their noses? You see what a mess you get into? When you try to go wandering around in those thin gray settlings that slosh around between the ears of teabaggers and pass for brains? Going for the graphic. Marty says, one of them could have been French. Instead of shunning the nose, they could unclog their noses. You know, Monty Python and the Holy Grail style. Is that it? We got a Monty Python teabagger here? From the Ministry of Nose Shunning? It's hard to say. But then there is, really, I want to get back to this guy. The Wisconsin contingent of the Horn family may weigh in if they wish to share with us just what is going through the minds of the people in Wisconsin's 20th Senate District. Because God knows they've got a bunch of other Lulus in that Senate now, too. I hear via Twitter, and my buddy Fruity Wisco, I think I've got that right, as well as my friends at the Pinocchio Education Project, Fruity Wisco sent me an internet on the Twitter just to remind me that right-wing Republican Senator Voss, V-O-S-S, no, I'm sorry, this is in the Assembly, not a Senator. Speaker-elect Robin Voss, R. Rochester, and Majority Leader Scott Souter, R. Abbotsford, announced the first bill they will introduce in the 2013-2014 session of the Wisconsin legislature will be legislation to reform the outdated mining laws in Wisconsin. Mining reform is a top priority in the state assembly, said Speaker-elect Voss. I'm hopeful all the interested parties can come together to protect our environment and make mining reform happen. Well, Speaker-elect Voss, I got to tell you, it ain't going to happen. Because you can't have mining reform of the sort that you want, you know, that sort of opens the Pandora's box of toxicity and dumps it all over that lovely, lovely, lovely state and protect that lovely, lovely, lovely state's environment at the same time. It cannot happen. They are mutual. They are what we call in the realm of, you know, logic, mutually exclusive. Lots of questions to be answered, but I'd like to know, in particular, though, I'd like to know what in the F is going on somewhere around Shorewood, Wisconsin, which is apparently where the 20th Senate District of Wisconsin is. Not too far from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Because Glenn Grothman, who says that, no, really, that Columbus founded, you know, cornerstones and that kind of crap. Columbus founded America. Who was perplexed in his own notes at the fact that the grateful natives, whom he thought were somehow just a different breed of Chinamen, and I don't say that derogatorily, that's his word, he couldn't understand why it was they didn't like being slaves to Spanish people. and would rather, you know, die. And even if they would not rather die, why it was that they were dying anyway? He wondered, scratching himself from not having bathed for God knows how long, and looking at all of his other shipmates there, also scratching themselves, also not having bathed, and noticing that even the flies that were buzzing around them were buzzing around them with little handkerchiefs over their disease-ridden mouths. He wondered why they were dying. Yeah, Glenn Grothman. It is Grothman. It's not Grothman, is it? It's got to be Grothman. Columbus founded America. Jim writes in to let us know. Yes, says Jim, I saw that fool too. I could not believe the interview. Subject of interview was certifiable. Certified teabagger, more than likely. I hope nobody shuns their nose at him. Well, that's just not going to go away, is it? No, Glenn Grothman is all head up about Kwanzaa, which is, unless I miss my guess, this being the third day of January 2013, over! But he's not just head up about Kwanzaa. He put out a press release dated December the 28th, 2013. By the way, this goober insists on keeping his office open, his public office in the State Senate of Wisconsin, as a symbolic gesture. He keeps his office open on Martin Luther King Day. Yeah, really. He keeps his office open on Martin Luther King Day. And by the way, we'll get to that later. He writes, for immediate release, for further information, please contact Glenn Grothman, area code 608-266-7513, office, area code 262-689-8421, cell phone. Why must we still hear about Kwanzaa? And then, in bold, has the word Madison, colon. And I don't understand. I don't know if that means this originates from Madison, Wisconsin, or if he is trying to suggest that this is some sort of lost but recently come to light part of the Federalist Papers. It's open to interpretation. Might depend on whether or not somebody has lately shunned their nose at you. Madison, colon. Why are hardcore left-wingers still trying to talk about Kwanzaa? Trying to talk about Kwanzaa as if we, you know, left-wingers. It won't quite come out of our mouth. It's like, you know, like Beetlejuice or something. See, I'm trying to talk about Kwanzaa. But I can't quite. Because we left-wingers, we're still trying to talk about Kwanzaa. Trying. Maybe it's because our noses have been shunned. Why are hardcore left-wingers still trying to talk about Kwanzaa, the supposed African-American holiday celebration between Christmas and New Year's? Might this be a lovely moment to talk about ethnocentrism? About the fact that members of ethnicities get to actually determine what is important to members of that given ethnicity, and that we understand that not all ethnicities will have identical prioritizations of given events. I think it would be a good time. The supposed African-American holiday celebration between Christmas and New Year's. It's only a supposed celebration, I guess, because Glenn Grothman's never been to one. As has been well publicized, no footnotes, Kwanzaa is not some African or African-American tradition. Ethnocentrism. Well, that's probably not a good definition of ethnocentrism, is it? But you know what I'm getting at. Glenn Grothman, who I may as well go ahead and just give this part away, is not a black guy. Looks like probably, well, I mean, he's so pale as to be, you know, one eye gene away from making Edgar Winter look like Bob Marley. I mean, it's a pale dude. As has been well publicized, no footnotes, Kwanzaa is not some African-American or African tradition. It was invented in 1966, you know, kind of like the way Columbus founded America.
Jesus.
By Ron Karenga, a 1960s radical leader and founder of something called the US Organization. This group, often referred to as the United Slaves, is even more radical than the Black Panthers. Is. Interesting use of the tense of the verb to be. Is. And Black Panthers. The United Slaves killed two Black Panther members, and Karenga himself wound up going to prison for assaulting some of his own members. Karenga was a racist and didn't like the idea that Christ died for all our sins, so he felt blacks should have their own holiday, hence Kwanzaa. Hence acid. Can you guys, please, if you can sort that one out, that's just one paragraph, let me know, email, phone, I don't care. Of course, almost no black people today care about Kwanzaa. Man, you... Oh, God... Because I got the picture of Glenn Grothman here, and I can just see him knocking on doors in the hood. Pardon me, ma'am. Do you care about Kwanzaa? Lord, no. Thank you, ma'am. Pardon me, sir. Do you care about Kwanzaa? I'm sorry. It's probably not as funny to hear as it is what I see in my head. If only I was a movie maker. Imagine... Well, never mind. Hence, Kwanzaa. Of course, almost no black people today care about Kwanzaa. Just white left-wingers who try to shove this down black people's throats in an effort to divide Americans. Because, you know, all holiday season long... I was getting emails from you guys, and, hey, did you hear Tom Hartman telling all the black people to celebrate Kwanzaa this year? My goodness gracious, Stephanie Miller certainly was pressing that Kwanzaa agenda. Well, goodness me, yeah, right. Irresponsible public school districts, such as Green Bay and Madison... and who knows how many others, see links below, try to tell a new generation that blacks have a separate holiday than Christians. Isn't he doing what he complains of there? Isn't he suggesting that there's a difference between black folks and Christians? Well, we've got a president now that didn't even get proper married with his wife, and he jumped a broom like they done in Roots. Waring Fink, left-wing West Bend lawyer and vice chair of the Washington County Democratic Party, encouraged people to learn more about Kwanzaa in a column in July. Well, if that doesn't... that doesn't just tell you everything you needed. Because it doesn't. Fortunately, almost all black people ignore wearing Think. Because again, he got his little briefcase and went, pardon me, ma'am, do you pay attention to wearing Think? Oh, God. Come on, progressive Wisconsinians. Can you not get this guy a one-way ticket to Alabama? He fit right in. You know, once he got past the notion of asking, of saying, yes, I'll have a grit. But why do they do it? They don't like America and seek to destroy it by pretending that its values as expressed in the Declaration of Independence and our Constitution, which we celebrate at Christmas, by the way, did you know? Yeah. Don't apply to everyone. Well, Glenn, there's that three-fifths clause in the Constitution. I mean, you know, just saying. I mean, the original draft of the Constitution didn't apply to everyone, did it? Mainstream Americans must be more outspoken on this issue. By mainstream Americans, he means ignorant teabag racists. It's time it's slapped down once and for all. Okay, that's a little pronounly confusing. With tens of millions of honorable black Americans in our country's past. I know some honorable black Americans in our country's past. Really, I do. They told me about them when I was knocking on the doors. But this, we should not let a violent nut like Karenga speak for them. Them. We should not let Karenga speak for them. Doesn't that imply that white folks have a right to determine who will speak for them? Why, yes, as a matter of fact, it does. Sweet Jesus! Marty. Me, I don't care about Kwanzaa either. No paid days off. Besides, I thought hardcore left-wingers would rather talk about Festivus or Solstice or something. Right on both counts. Clayton, the militant sociologist, Bob, as your token pagan, tell these jerks that I want all my Christmas shit back. You know, the Yule log, the Yule tree. You want your Easter shit back too, Clayton? You know, the rabbits that lay the eggs? The goldfish left thinking logs in me sock drawer. That's right, Sonny, and that's the story of Easter. Jesus Christ. Paren, after speak for them, which I'm still getting over. By the way, after getting out of prison, he was hired as a professor at California State Long Beach. When are we going to stop funding left-wing nuts at our public universities? Yeah, because that's California, Long Beach, Wisconsin. Yeah, I don't think so. The churches ought to be particularly appalled since Karenga thought Christmas was a white religion and, well, kinda is. Sorta is. I mean, if you take the fact that the essential teachings of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer, were pretty much left laying in the dust of Jerusalem as Paul, who changed his name from Saul in order to dodge the law, left all that do unto others crap sitting in the dust and took his Mithras wannabe myth up into Greece among the white folks. Christianity is a white folks' religion. Not to put too fine a point on it, but number of black popes. One, maybe. And that's a big maybe. we're more certain that we have had a gay president in the form of James Buchanan than we are that the Roman Catholic Church had a black pope. Because he came from, what, North Africa, and Africa does not necessarily mean white, especially when we're dealing with the post-Roman Empire period. Just say what you will about Glenn Grothman. He is not going to hide his feeble, flickering light under a bushel. He will tell the State University System of California what it ought to do. He will tell the entirety of black America what it ought to do. He'll tell the churches what they ought to do. And then he tells us all, be on the lookout if a K-12 or college teacher tries to tell your children or grandchildren it's a real holiday. We have a grammar problem here. Be on the lookout if a K-12 or college teacher tries to tell your children or grandchildren it's a real holiday. It is a contraction that is a back reference to something previous in the sentence. I'm not sure if K-12 is a real holiday or college is a real holiday. Or perhaps whether lookout is in fact a holiday. And to think, not only do we turn the likes of Glenn Grothman loose with apparently a typewriter, or maybe just a sharp stick and a little pile of batshit, he's also eligible to own firearms. Wow. I am pierced. Thorn in the side Thursday indeed. And lots of them. A story we will get to, it kind of indirectly relates to a story we'll get to in the second hour. Our buddy Tosh writes in. Subject line, High Noon at the Strip Mall Saloon. I thought it was interesting to hear that NYPD stats show that they hit their target with 15% of their shots in a shootout. That means trained, professional peace officers who presumably maintain their proficiency miss over 5 out of 6 times. See, Tosh is proficient with that mathematics stuff. I couldn't have figured that out on the fly if my life had depended on it. That means trained professional peace officers who presumably maintain their proficiency miss over 5 out of 6 times. As I noted, and it was broadcast on the Stephanie Miller Show, Jared Lochner is alive despite the presence of an armed guard at that event. The problem was the armed guard was worried about hitting an innocent bystander and therefore did not shoot. I pointed out that the people we trust enough to arm are not crazy enough to start shooting into a crowd or playing Rambo in a school building. The crazies are willing to play first-person shooter with real people because that is the context of their sickness, but for the person we'd officially trust with a firearm, not so much. I asked a church friend and a sheriff's department captain and promoted superintendent of the police academy, who confirmed that trained personnel are taught not to shoot into such a scene. They are now trained to enter a building with an active shooter instead of waiting for the full SWAT team, but that is an innovation that has come online since Columbine. This month's Esquire magazine, just as a sidebar, this month's Esquire magazine contains in a series of interviews about heroes and what gives meaning to life, contains an interview with the police officer who was first to arrive on the scene at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin. And he has a very vivid memory of getting shot up. In point of fact, he drew the attention of the killer sufficiently that he spent more he spent more fire on the officer, and thereby quite likely saved a number of lives in that temple. He was, of course, a right-winger armed to the teeth, this murderer. And the police officer says, I remember thinking to myself, my God, is he ever going to run out of bullets? And, of course, the NRA's answer to that is, we certainly hope not, because that's a sign of freedom, them 100-round banana clips. Some people call it a sling clip. I call it a banana clip. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's my aside. Back to what Tosh says. I think I've mentioned my former Penn State University dorm mate who survived an LSD-induced suicide attempt because he couldn't get a gun for 3 days. He decided he'd had enough of the flashbacks. This guy had done serious quantities of LSD before college and couldn't sleep anymore, so he went to the local hardware store in State College. I recall the place. We had one in College Park, too, to get a gun to blow his brains out. The owner was willing to sell him a gun, but he had to wait for the background check to come back. Not willing to wait 3 days, he decided he'd blow out his brains with a massive dose of the hair of the dog that had bit him, LSD. He took something like 20 hits. On Monday, when he could have picked up the gun, he was in the local psych ward. Last time I saw him was the next year when I visited my old dorm during a visit to see Maryland lose to Penn State in Beaver Stadium. He'd spent most of that year in a hospital but was still alive. My brother was working on a suicide by cop plan, which I talked him out of about 20 years back. He was going to make a zip gun, pull it on a cop, and hope the cop would shoot him to death. He'd had enough of the voices. I pointed out that the cop might not kill him, so there he'd be in jail and still stuck with the voices. Almost worked. He switched from SBC, suicide by cop, to trying with a car rigged to explode. He didn't tell me about this plan, but it failed because he needed to crash into a building to trigger the bomb, and chose a building where he couldn't get going fast enough to set off the bomb. The bomb was a full-size oxy bottle from his welding gear that would have blown him, the car, and much of the building to kingdom come. Trashed the car and hurt himself. But he still lives. Google the ABC shooter experiment, Tosh says. They trained a group of college students and then armed them in a test. For each student, they armed them and then sent them into a room with other students, actually police officers and extras, wanting of some training. While waiting, a shooter came in and shot the teacher. Chaos ensues on tape. None of the 8 students was successful in defending anyone. Several of them actually probably would have died from wounds they received because they thought to take cover. They forgot to take cover before shooting. One couldn't get the gun out of their holster. His holster. We saw that in Vermont. There are rednecks there, too. One of the neighbors near my grandparents came down the street to show us what he'd done and invited us to the house which he was building in the woods. What he'd done was shoot himself in the thigh. He was playing quick draw at his house using a steel-lined holster. One time, the muzzle didn't clear the holster before he fanned it. The bullet traveled down the inside of the holster into his thigh. This is how real quick draw artists work, except for the muzzle thing. Closing, Tosh asks, can we try to return to the full meaning of the Second Amendment? A well-regulated militia means that, like in Colonial Williamsburg, the guns, mostly long rifles, are kept under lock and key in an armory, sort of how a volunteer fire department keeps their trucks at the fire station. These state militias were our military in many cases, including the Civil War, where on both sides the state raised regiments. Where do you think the term 145th Pennsylvania Regiment came from? My ancestors, says Tosh, were 1st or 2nd Vermont. Sorry. Nothing to apologize for. Nothing at all. Yeah, then there's the 4th Alabama. Of course, my folks were back up here in what was then Virginia and would later become West Virginia. This is a fascinating story of the 4th Alabama, though. North Alabama was not a really slavey place. Not a lot of slaveholders. And so a bunch of dirt farmers who really didn't have, who recognized that they didn't have a dog in the aristocracy's fight to continue owning other human beings, raised their own regiment. and volunteered for the Union. And they served admirably, the 4th Alabama did. And I think some of their some of their paraphernalia, maybe even their regimental flag, or maybe their, well, yeah, stars and stripes with 4th Alabama, you know, emblazoned upon it. Still exist. Yeah. I thought Tasha's email was particularly important and telling and fitting within this conversation. Because of a little something going on just a bit to the west of where I am in that state known to the rest of us as Ohio. Now, we've seen stories about stuff like this out of Texas, but yeah, that's Texas. No offense to my Texas friends, I think, even though, yeah, well, you know, it's Texas, we do this kind of thing. But Fox 19 in Ohio, Delaware, Ohio, according to the Dateline, is reporting the Buckeye Firearms Foundation will be providing free firearms training to teachers and school administrative staff. This announcement is following the devastating shooting that left 27 dead at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut in December. As of Wednesday, you know, yesterday, the Armed Teacher Training Program, sit down for this one, please. As of Wednesday, the Armed Teacher Training Program, the ATTP, has attracted more than 600 applicants from several states, including Ohio, Arizona, California, Florida, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Nevada, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Texas, Washington, and damn it, West Virginia. Jim Irvine is chairman of the Buckeye Arms Firearms Foundation. He said, "We knew this would be popular, but the response has exceeded expectations." I'm guessing that's a typo and not a matter of nose shunning. "People doubted if we would fill the first class. That happened in ours. This is something many in our schools have been asking about for a long time." While the state of Ohio generally prohibits firearms at school, the law includes a provision that allows teachers and staff to carry firearms if approved by the school board, because they also have a law in Ohio that allows you to carry firearms to a football game, too. In a bar. In a church. Yeah. "No one will be forced to be armed if they choose not to. The strategy is the same as ordinary concealed carry. No one will ever know who is or is not armed. Those who seek to do harm in schools should be met with armed resistance, even before law enforcement shows up. Over time, schools will no longer be considered easy, risk-free targets." What Tosh said there a minute ago about suicide by cop? The guys who decide, and they are mostly guys, who decide to go in and shoot up places generally don't care if they get blown away. This is the old, we'll fry him in the electric chair to deter murder argument, when there has never been any proof whatsoever that capital punishment serves as any sort of a deterrent to murder. Because once you've got murder in your heart, see, and in your mind, well, things like moral considerations of how society will punish you have pretty much gone out the window. Right? Right. Kyle, let's see. More than a third of the program's applicants are women, while 70% of the applicants are teachers. Applicants also include administrators, office staff, and guidance counselors. More than half the applicants work in high schools. Graduates of the Armed Teacher Training Program will have to pass the same test as law enforcement. Nothing in here about having to pass a mental health exam, though. How do you like that? Interesting. And did you notice that part about how no one will ever know who has the guns? Okay, let me get my tinfoil hat on here for a minute. Is this another way to undermine public education by is this another right wing attempt to undermine the validity of public education? Would you send your child to a school if you had the slightest inkling that some insufficiently trained, harried public school teacher or private school teacher or administrator or coach? Hey, coach, we got a shooter over in the auditorium. Yeah, well, tell him to do 10 laps, little bastard. Would you send your child to a school where it was just sort of the luck of the draw and you had no way of knowing whether your child was in a class with a firearm? Would you send your child to a school knowing, as we all do, that the odds of someone being harmed by a firearm are much higher than a crime being prevented by one? But here's a second question. Would you have the courage, and I am not challenging your courage, this is a straight up question because I don't know if I would you have the courage to go to a school board meeting and demand to know if your child was being taught by teachers who were packing heat? Or would you fear that your children would be subject to some form of reprisal for being sissy, lily-livered, commie, non-Second Amendment, America love, not lovers, and Wolverines, right? Jack writes in from Shreveport. If we were to take the well-regulated militia being necessary as a conditional rather than a simple preface, i.e. subjunctive rather than indicative, it seems we could do away with the constitutional problem of gun ownership altogether. Yes, we could. The problem is that in the Heller decision, Fat Tony Scalia said that whole business about well-regulated militia was meaningless language, just kind of like the way a person adds a flourish to their signature underneath their name. Means nothing. Isn't that interesting for a Supreme Court justice who says that he has the magic power to discern the intent of the framers of the Constitution of the United States based upon the plain language contained in it, that he can look at plain language that says a well-regulated militia being necessary, blah, 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 and simply declare that it has no meaning whatsoever? That it's like, I don't know, jurisprudential meringue? Isn't that fascinating? Ray, writing from Florida, I assume the teachers are going to be packing assault weapons since most attackers are. You you would think. But then again, those are going to be kind of hard to conceal, and these are concealed carry teachers. Robert, writing in from Australia, Bob, do the people who want armed teachers in schools understand how mad that seems to the rest of the world? And how long after this is implemented will it be before the report of the first student to be accidentally shot will appear? Probably the day after, Robert. But that first question speaks volumes. Do the people who want armed teachers in schools understand how mad that seems to the rest of the world? Well, yes and no, Robert. The gun goobers think, they understand that you think it is absolutely lunatic to want something like this. But they think that's because the rest of the world are a bunch of panty-waisted sissies. Their words, not mine. Remember the lady, remember the woman who said that we could have avoided the Sandy Hook Elementary shootings if only there had been some huskier 12-year-olds who were willing to rush the guy with the semi-automatic assault rifle? Remember that she also said, this Charlotte Allen, that the problem at Sandy Hook Elementary was not one of easy, ready access to firearms, but one of the fact that there were no men on the premises, and that therefore the school had been feminized? Robert, the gun goobers recognize that the rest of the world thinks that it's just lunacy. But there's some pathology at work. And the pathology at work is as follows. Being nuts, they think they are sane. Being nuts, they think we are the ones with a problem. Because their reason is crystal clear and unassailable to them. And they cannot understand why they would why we can't see that just making this entire country an arm to the teeth Dodge City will somehow reduce violence. Making this nation more prone to violence will make it less violent. And because they are badly, badly mentally impaired, well, they can't even see their own hypocrisy. This won't take but about 3.5 minutes. This is a video that has gone down the memory hole and been disappeared from off of the National Rifle Association's website. You don't necessarily have to have the videos or the visual images in order to get the import of the voiceover. You see, over there at NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia, they've got them a museum. And their museum is a museum of firearms. You'll recall that blood-sodden psychopath Wayne LaPierre blamed Hollywood and the culture of violence, specifically citing a video game that's been pretty much off the radar for a long-ass time, Mortal Kombat, which involves, martial arts and not guns? As being the precipitating the proximate cause of things like Columbine and Sandy Hook and Virginia Tech and the shopping center at Tucson and the theater in Aurora, Colorado, and the mall in Oregon, and the temple in Wisconsin, and the shooting at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Tennessee, and on and on and on and on. All of which have the common element of firearms, but none of which have been proven to be directly related to either American Psycho the movie or Mortal Kombat the video game. But it's Hollywood's fault, right? So imagine the irony when the folks over at Media Matters for America found out that the big to-do, the big display, the big show at NRA headquarters was going to be, lo and behold, Hollywood guns.
Welcome to the William B. Ruger Gallery of the National Firearms Museum. This year's special exhibit is called Hollywood Guns. It's in fact a sequel to a blockbuster exhibit we had back in 2002 entitled Real Guns of Real Heroes. This sequel has over 100 firearms that were used in some of the best remembered films from Hollywood's golden age all the way to modern time, as well as firearms that appeared on the silver screen in the hands of some of our daytime television heroes. The firearms on exhibit here range from the early 30s all the way up to films that haven't even come out in the theater yet. In fact, we have a pistol that Robert De Niro used in the movie Machete, which is yet to be released. We have the Joker's shotgun, the one that Keith Ledger used in The Dark Knight, a role that he won the Academy Award for. And speaking of Academy Awards, we have the silent shotgun that Javier Bardem used in No Country for Old Men, the Barrett 50 cal that was used in The Hurt Locker. Both of those garnered Best Picture awards at the Academy Awards ceremonies. The Maltese Falcon of 1941 is consistently rated as one of the top 10 American films of all time. You obviously may or may not remember too much gunplay in that film. A Webley Fosbury, a very rare revolver to show up in movies, does make an appearance. But the entire story revolves around a golden bird that was given by the Knights of Malta to Charles V of Spain in 1539. We actually have the original Maltese Falcon from the film. It weighs over 40 pounds and stands but only 11.5 inches tall. And it's probably the most valuable film prop in all of Hollywood history. We have an 1895 Colt potato digger that was used in 1916 in the Paramount Home Guard, loaned to us by the descendants of J.B. Stembridge's famed prop house at Paramount Studios. This potato digger was put into action at the request of famed director Cecil B. DeMille in forming the Paramount Home Guard to help drill and equip and train both actors and crew and cast members in military maneuvers, just in case Hollywood would be called on to actually help in the defense of the country in 1916 through 1918. Stembridge again answered the country's call in 1941 when Pearl Harbor was bombed by lending the Ordnance Department at Fort MacArthur, California, 5 Thompson machine guns that were fully operational, along with 5 20-round magazines for each one of those machine guns. But that's just a small insight into some of the many guns that are here on display. The exhibit runs for the course of the calendar year, and we hope to run it all the way into mid-2011. We're very fortunate to have a number of friends out in Southern California that have lent us their collections, both personal and the collection of their businesses. So we encourage you to come by and visit this sequel and come see a true blockbuster here in Fairfax, where all the stars in silver screen have descended into these galleries and are represented by some of the firearms that we've fallen in love with in our youth and our adulthood, wishing that could be like our matinee idols.
Yeah. Wishing we could be like our matinee idols. Thanks to our good friends at Media Matters for America for catching that little hypocritical gem from the blood-sodden sociopaths at the National Rifle Association. Damn, this turned into a filibuster that ran half of the program. We got to stop this quick. We'll take a little break and come back. You know the number, 304-658-3333. Or on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid Horn. Skype is enabled and the phone lines are open, so by all means, feel free to share your thoughts. It's Thorn in the Side Thursday. We are $10 toward our $150 fundraising goal for the evening. That just means 14 more folks at $10 apiece. You know, 7 at 20. Right, you get the idea. It is how this all keeps going, however, and there are bills to pay in the new year. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. And I'm Bob Kincaid.
Once that you've decided on a killing, first you make a stone of your heart. And if you find that your hands are still willing, then you can turn a murder into art. There really isn't any need for bloodshed. Just do it with a little more finesse. If you can slip a tablet into someone's carpet, then it avoids an awful lot.
your second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Minutes before the hour, a little follow-up, a nerve having been touched, several of them as a matter of fact, by the audio coming from the blood-sodden sociopaths at the National Rifle Association. Going back to the question that I asked, subject line, teachers with Pete. Kim writes in and says, yes, Bob, I could go to the school board and ask such a question. Do I think it is right for a teacher to carry a gun? I can't answer that right now. I'm still taking that thought in and tossing it about in my mind. What I do know is this. How can we ask a teacher, to now carry a gun, an added job to the job they already do, with the small and insignificant pay they are now receiving? Will they have to buy and register their own gun? Will it be school-owned and picked up at the front desk every morning? Parenthetically, Kim adds, shaking my head. Ray says, oh, and by the way, Bob, not to mention that Glenn Beck has told the gun people that Obama is coming to put them in camps. Did I get that right earlier? That we had the story about current TV being sold to Al Jazeera. I heard something earlier today. I do not offer this as fact, and it is not any form of prediction because I don't have my magic robe on, nor my magic eight ball. But did I understand correctly that Glenn Beck tried to buy current TV? Oh, he is desperate, isn't he, our little Glenn? Juanita, whom we talked to on Monday night, New Year's Eve, and had such a lovely conversation, under the subject line, guns in the classroom, Juanita says, do you remember this incident in the news? This is what happened when a DEA agent gave a talk on gun safety in a classroom. Let's see if this will load.
If somebody ever comes around you talking to you about drugs, run away from it. You understand what I'm saying? Run away from it. And see, I got these drugs that I'm going to talk to you guys about. I have a whole lot more to tell you. I don't have a whole lot of time. I got these guns. I have a gun outside right here. Just this week, at the beginning of the week, a young boy, not even 16 years old, was killed because he was playing with a gun. And see, this is an unloaded gun. Right here. This is a gun. No, empty weapon. Empty weapon. This is a Glock 40. 50 Cent, Too Short, all of them talking about Glock 40. Okay, I'm the only one in this room professional enough that I know of to carry this Glock 40. I'm the only one. No, I'm all right. Everybody all right? You all right? No, this is Paul. Yeah. Listen up, guys. But listen up. And I made a mistake. So listen to me. Guys, listen to me. Yeah, listen to me. See that how the accident happened? It can happen to you and you can be blown away. Okay?
It could happen to you and you could be blown away. He's a professional, however, and only wounded himself. That's real. That really happened. Thank you for the reminder, Juanita. Michael writing in. With regard to the NRA, he says, quoting from the NRA's little promotional video for their blockbuster of guns display. Quote, wishing we could be like our matinee idols. Really? Does that include Heath Ledger's Joker, the psychopathic, schizophrenic, void of all empathy, mass murderer? A role which drove him mad and led to his suicide? Because they definitely made a point of mentioning Ledger's Joker in that video. I'm not digging on The Dark Knight, but wishing I could be the Joker wasn't my reaction to that film. But having never fallen in love with a firearm, maybe I just don't understand. Yeah, me neither. I was a little... And then of course, there's the follow-up. And then, of course, there's Javier Bardem's silent shotgun. Yeah, go ahead. Glorify that, why don't you, National Rifle Association? Maybe some enterprising kid can build himself one of those, so we won't know until maybe there's 30 or 40 or 50 dead children before somebody realizes their shotgun's going off. Yeah. Many thanks. We are now at the $30 mark, meaning we have $120 more to go in the fundraising department this evening. We've got lines open, but we're going to the phones, 304-658-3333, or on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
What's happening, Jim?
Not a whole lot, just listening to you and looking at TV and just thinking about teachers with guns. That's a real new concept, isn't it?
I don't know if it's new or not, but it's disconcerting. I mean, really, honest to God, these were 5 and 6 year olds who were shot in Connecticut. Are we going to suggest? I mean, children are curious by nature, correct? It's part of our primateness. We're really going to have armed kindergarten teachers? I mean, we're talking about kids that are just that aren't even completely convinced that they ought not stick their fingers in light sockets.
I don't know. There's a very good possibility that they may, in fact, enact these programs.
Well, I mean, this thing in Ohio is strictly voluntary. It's not a government program, but you've got people signing up from as far away as Arizona.
My point exactly.
And they make a point of telling us, and no one will ever know who's got a gun.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Is this the, I mean, we know that there are air marshals, for instance. On any given flight, anywhere in America, the theory behind it is the potential terrorist never knows when they're going to get on a plane that has an armed-to-the-teeth air marshal on it.
Oh, yeah, that's been in effect since the 70s.
But even the idea of, particularly the idea of gunplay, and I even kind of hate that word, play, of gunfire inside a pressurized aircraft?
Well, remember Goldfinger?
Yes.
Gert Frobe just got put right out, didn't he?
Right.
My point exactly. I will never forget the lines from that movie. My name is Pussy Galore, and Sean Connery says, I must be dreaming. I'm not making light of what you say, but anyway, I just, when I thought about that, and I thought about around passing through an individual and going through the pressurized compartment of an airplane at 35,000 feet, well, you know what's going to happen. It's not going to be real, real fun for anybody. So, I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't have any solutions to it, but listen, I got a request for you.
All right.
At some point before the program ends, I wish you would play one song for me.
I will try if I have it available to me.
It's out there. It's called Hypnotized by the Pointer Sisters. And I think that song has a lot of relevance to a lot of stuff we've been talking about for a long, long time.
Well, I will see right now. Is this the same? Has it been covered by other folks too? I mean,
no. It's right there. It's right there on.
Okay.
YouTube.
Let me see if I can get it going here. Yep, that's
Bonnie Pointer. Let me tell you, those girls could sing.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, here it is. Okay, well, we'll get it going.
I appreciate that very much.
Oh, no trouble at all.
And I don't have a whole lot to say other than what I've said, and I'm going to get off here and let you do what you got to do.
All right, thanks, Jim.
Good night, sir.
Take care. Bye now. Our buddy Jim, who has the soul of a DJ. Well, I trust Jim's taste. Let's give a listen. About 6 minutes before the hour. Hour or so's worth of conversation left in the program if you want to get involved. For Jim, by request, hearkening back unto my old days as a disc jockey, that's the Pointer Sisters cover of the old, one of the earliest Fleetwood Mac hits, a song penned by Bob Welch, who passed away this past year, Hypnotized. I'd never heard that version before. And it's that cover. I like it. Because, yeah, Pointer Sisters did have quite a set of pipes. Back to the firearms issue. And you know what? I said time and time again that I, after every one of these massacres, that I didn't necessarily know what more there was to be said. That it was going to keep on happening and keep on happening and keep on happening. But maybe that's the point. Maybe there's not something new to be said. Maybe it is the fact that we must object and object and object and object and object to our children, our loved ones, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, cousins, husbands, wives, fathers, mothers, grandmothers, grandfathers, being involuntarily led into the NRA's abattoir, and we must object until it is stopped. Maybe that's the point. Maybe for once we don't give up before we get started. Maybe it's worth keeping this in the front of our consciousness, and not, as is the case here, I admit, moving on to the next horror, the next disgrace, quite so easily. Jack writes in from Shreveport. He says, Bob, I just saw this letter to the editor in my local paper. This was one of those things at which I asked myself several times if this was April Fool's Day. By the end, I decided that this letter was probably meant to be taken seriously. It's short, Jack says, so I included the whole letter. And notice that the writer says, so as not to alarm or panic the whole building. Wouldn't just the existence of what the writer proposes incite at least some fear or panic every single day to the students and the teachers? So here's the letter. It comes from, this is from the Shreveport Times, ShreveportTimes.com. It is from someone by the name of Lorne Michaud. The Shreveport Times calls it Suggestions for Better School Security. Lorne Michaud says, I believe the following suggestions will help solve a security system for schools. I have questions about the use of that language. Solve a security system for schools. That means to defeat, to overcome. One, install a double door entry system with at least a 12-foot clearance space between the two walls. This space could be a square 12-foot cubicle cell. Huh, nice. Our children will enter a cell now in order to go and become edumacated. Two, the shooter would pass through the outside entrance door okay, but once inside the middle of this cubicle, he would set off magnetic alarms, one located in the principal's office and the other at the police station. Three, when the alarms are set off, all doors automatically locked down, keeping the shooter stranded in the cubicle space. The alarm in the principal's office could be a silent type so as not to alarm or panic the whole building. The principal could announce on the PA communication system if he chooses to do so to alert others. Five, in the meantime, the police station has contacted the nearest patrol car. Six, during this time, the shooter is trapped and waiting to be arrested. Walmart has a system similar to what I'm talking about. When a customer is finishing shopping and approaching the entrance exit door, an alarm will go off if the shopper is carrying any electronic device. The guard proceeds to check the sales receipt before giving his okay to exit. The customer walks about 12 feet before reaching the outside exit doors. That's from Lorne Michaud of Bossier City, Louisiana. Babylon on the Red River. Bossier City once upon a time. Great. Yeah, that's going to work so good. You know what that's going to lead them to do? You know, I mean, come on, you've already gotten there. You're sharper than I am. That's going to lead to what? Homicidal white men with high explosives strapped to their sides to blow the cell apart. This is the same old problem with locks and burglars. But at least this individual is not proposing that huskier 12-year-olds rush shooters. You know, double entries are not necessarily something always conceived to stop homicidal maniacs. They also have something to do with the heat and air conditioning bill. That's why there's usually a whoosh of somewhat of a little low-rent vacuum when you open the interior door. Right? But that's what passes for thought worthy of publication in this country. I go back to Robert's question about do the people who want armed teachers in schools understand how mad this seems to the rest of the world? Well, you know, some of those madmen, Robert, I mean, there are people in Australia who still want to gun up. This comes from Truth Out. It was published today. Mark Carlin, writing for BuzzFlash.com. In the beginning, God created the gun and generations of worshipers. An Australian, Nick Adams, Carlin writes, who is a gun fanatic sans gun in his home country, claims, "Nothing, ladies and gentlemen, nothing is more emblematic of the exceptionalism of America than the Second Amendment," to which I will simply say, "Hold on a minute, Buster. Thanks to people like Dr. Bill O'Brien, I know what American exceptionalism means, and it doesn't mean being all gunned up." Without the Second Amendment, Nick Adams continues, there are no other amendments. The rest of the Constitution is a recommendation. It defines what America is about. It speaks to the character of America and to the mentality and philosophy of the American. Now, buddy, then you don't understand American history. Because a well-regulated militia being necessary to a free state refers to, in particular, America's frontiers at or about 1789, which was just past the mountains, the Alleghenies and the Appalachians, and to a certain extent the Mississippi River, which was still largely a wild place. East of the Mississippi had high concentrations of native peoples who might not feel real good about having their land stolen from them by white folks who had already brought them things like diseases that had reduced their numbers from the millions into from tens of millions into digits of millions, single digits. So, no. The rest of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution itself do not rest upon the Second Amendment. It's another one of those cowboy fantasies that the National Rifle Association, blood-sodden sociopaths that they are, have lied into the American consciousness over God knows how many years. It speaks, Nick Adams says, to the character of America and to the mentality and philosophy of the American. No, it reflects why America came into being and the success of its human experiment. You know, Nick, if I were you, buddy, being not only sans gun, but apparently sans wisdom and sans real knowledge, I wouldn't use the phrase human and experiment back to back. Because this is a country that has, in fact, done quite a lot of human experimentation. We have experimented. With bondage, chattel slavery. That constitution, which you become so enamored of, was an experiment in determining what fraction a human being might be in order to placate paranoid white people in the American South, worried about what would happen should their African chattel slaves deem themselves fully human. We have had an experiment on eradicating the native population that existed on this continent, from which that native population has never recovered. The number of peoples on this continent who are fully 100% genetically still native is, as compared to the rest of us mutts, very small. Very small. Tiny in the United States, and made only slightly less so by the inclusion of Canada, and a little less so by the inclusion of Mexico in that demographic count. Even Mexico and Central America, where finding a person who is of non-Hispanic origin and yet has some sort of Hispanic name, even there, to be full-blooded native first peoples is a matter of derision. Did you know that? Once upon a time, Mexico began taking pride in its mixed race nature. But then even that reached the point where those who were still of fully indigenous blood were derided for it, given European Catholic names, Hispanic names, names given because someone was baptized on some saint's day. And so all 20 people in the pond would be named Juan, because it was Saint Juan somebody's feast day. So, Mr. Adams, let's not talk about a human experiment. He continues, civilian disarmament is based on the assumption that people are irresponsible unless they work for the government. America was founded on the opposite premise. No, dumbass. America was founded on the premise that the people, or at least some of them, you know, the landed property-owning people, are the government. Just as there is no greater moral imperative than keeping America strong, I would suggest there's a greater moral imperative than keeping America strong. I would suggest that one of the moral imperatives that is greater than keeping America strong is keeping the planet able to sustain life. Which, in fact, one could argue is at direct odds with the vast majority of opinion in this country, as well as the majority of governing philosophy. Just as there is no greater moral imperative than keeping America strong, there is no greater moral imperative than supporting and advocating the constitutional right to bear arms. See, I don't think... Hell no. I don't know. That line of reasoning, it doesn't work for me.
You keep using that word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
Yeah, moral imperative. No, me neither. Because, see, I think it is a far greater moral imperative that five-year-olds get to be six-year-olds and six-year-olds get to become seven-year-olds than making sure that some paranoid, pasty-faced, doughy-eyed, fat-ass white guy gets to keep 500 guns in his house. I mean, if we're going to talk about moral imperatives. And if we understand what moral imperative actually means. Mark Carlin writes, Adams issued this clarion call to gun worshippers in a keynote address at the Arizona NRA Centenary Banquet on June 2, 2012 in Phoenix, Arizona. He noted plaintively at the time, Carlin says, ladies and gentlemen, and Robert, this is the part you'll like. Angry, this is the part you'll like. Yeah. Australian members of the Horn family. This is the part you're just going to love. Ladies and gentlemen, I belong to a generation of Australians that have never picked up a gun. When I was just 11 years old, the federal government implemented gun reform in the wake of a dreadful and heart-wrenching massacre conducted by an insane man garnishing an AR-15. I saved that part. Isn't it lovely the way the universe works? The flying spaghetti monster, the goddess of irony, whomever she, he, it may be. The program begins with Dustin Stockton, Texas and Nevada-based operative and chief strategist of the TeaParty.net. We now have 85 members of the House who have shunned their noses at us. Meanwhile, it turns out, back in June of 2012, we had a goober from Australia come all the way over to Arizona. It's a long flight. To tell Arizona NRA Centenary Banquet attendees, who did not even snicker when he said it, when I was just 11 years old, the federal government implemented gun reform in the wake of a dreadful and heart-rending wrenching massacre. See, I think it's heart-rending. I mean, wrenching works, but the actual phrase, I think, is heart-rending, because it breaks the heart in pieces. It rends the heart. It tears at the heart. To wrench it just means you kind of give it a little torque. Conducted by an insane man garnishing an AR-15. Now this guy, we've already established with paragraphs 1, 2, 3, and 4. We're in paragraph 5 now. But in paragraphs 1, 2, 3, and 4, we've already established that this guy is a real Lulu. That he is about as perceptive of American history and American so-called culture as a hog is about Sunday church wear. So can I ask a question of those who speak the Australian version of this here language? If you guys and ladies, if you wave something about in Australian English, are you said to be garnishing it? Or if, on the other hand, you have just prepared a lovely plate of fried halibut, golden crusted, and you put it on the plate, and you take a little wedge of lemon, and perhaps, Jesus, I'm beginning to sound like Garrison Keillor, a little wedge of lemon and perhaps a little piece of parsley, and you arrange it strategically on the plate so as to make it more visually appealing, have you garnished the fish? As opposed to garnishing AR-15. These people get so earnest and so strident, and they don't realize that they're so stupid. Perhaps that's where their earnestness and their stridency arises. When I was just 11 years old, the federal government implemented gun reform in the wake of a dreadful and heart-wrenching massacre conducted by an insane man garnishing an AR-15. The government of day implemented a comprehensive and elaborate gun buyback scheme where Australians, the compliant people that we are, visited. You know, I can come up with a lot of different adjectives to describe Australians. Compliant, guys, ladies, is not one of them. Most of the adjectives I would come up with are quite complimentary. But compliant? Somehow you are compliant because you prefer to see 5-year-olds become 6-year-olds? Because you prefer that grandmothers go on doing grandmotherly things for their grandsons and granddaughters? That makes you compliant? The government of day implemented a comprehensive and elaborate gun buyback scheme where Australians, the compliant people that we are, visited our local police stations and handed in our firearms. Is this somebody who's known down there? Or up there, if we want to be less boreally centric on this planet. Do you guys know this Nick Adams character? Who apparently yearns to be as gunned up as the goobers here. Jesus, this comes from a piece that he wrote called America, the Last Bullet in the Chamber. In talking about the compliant Australians who turned in their guns in the buyback, he says, in doing this, the government, while well-intentioned, took the guns out of the hands of the law-abiding citizen, leaving only the criminals armed. In the 16 years since this reform, there has been negligible change to the crime rate other than a spike in knife activity and violent assault. He neglects to mention the fact that there haven't been any more Port Arthur massacres. In Australia, he says, any advocate of gun ownership is considered extreme and dangerous. The Daisy Red Ryder BB gun that my father played with as a child and sat under many an Australian Christmas tree for generations is outlawed unless you have a special permit. Safe. Serial code stamp. It goes on and on and on as he pisses and moans about not being able to have a BB gun. He says, you take away the guns of America, you take away America. And then offers a sort of manifesto. America is not, to this guy, this Nick Adams creep, America is nothing. America is nothing but guns. We are to be measured by our caliber and not our character. We are to be measured by our bore and not the breadth of our spirit. We are to be measured by the length of our barrels and not the height of our aspirations. You take away the guns of America, you take away America. Let's set this record straight here, because I'm done with the elites and their misinformation. I'm done with the namby-pamby society. You know, namby-pamby society, that's right-wing, blood-sodden, NRA, sociopathic code for people who want to see their children grow up. I'm done with the effete urbanites. Effete, you see. Effete. Because if the urbanites would only gun up and make every city in the United States an armed camp where no one dared look another in the eye, this would be a nation worth having. I'm done with the world citizen politicians, because, you know, after all, we can poison the entirety of an entire planet, but as long as one little chunk is still livable, well, then our 1% betters will have a place they can live in, and the rest of us can just fend for ourselves in some sort of weird Mad Max-like dystopia. They have fired thousands of volleys of shots, wielding their weapon of distortion in their war on individual liberty, and the casualties have been truth and reality. The truth of the matter is that Mr. Adams apparently doesn't give a good goddamn how many of our babies we put beneath the dirt in some sort of sick obedience to the Second Amendment. And here it comes again. The right to bear arms is not wrong, immoral, evil, bad, or unnecessary. It's the opposite. The right to bear arms is the greatest test of genuine freedom, the best protection of you, your family, and your property, the greatest deterrent of governmental overreach, the greatest disincentive to foreign invasion, the greatest defense to the two cancers of the West, radical Islam and socialism, and the greatest asset to a confident and individualistic society. This man needs medication. Really. The greatest deterrent of governmental overreach, the greatest disincentive to foreign... You know, he doesn't say anything about here... anything here about firearms being a disincentive or a deterrent to corporate parasitism or corporate predation upon one's very life. Now, we are armed to the freaking teeth here in West Virginia. Liberal, progressive, conservative, teabagger, what have you, we got us some guns. And I have not seen, I mean, we're one of the most highly gunned up states in the Union, but I haven't seen the presence of any of those guns yet stop a child from being deformed in the womb by the 4.5 to 5.5 million pounds of high explosives that go off every day in this state. One of which explosions went off at precisely 3 minutes past 5 p.m. just today as I was sitting back here doing preparation for the show. I haven't seen one of those firearms slow down Alpha Natural Resources or Consol or Arch in their relentless effort to trade our lives in favor of their profits without our consent. Talk about namby-pamby, Mr. Adams. Why don't you just come live here for a little while, Buster? Why don't you come live underneath a mountaintop removal site and breathe that filth every day of your life and watch your loved ones get sick? And you can have all the goddamn guns you want. And let's see what you do with them, you miserable coward, you little pissant, you. He says, if you don't understand why owning a gun is important or necessary, you don't get freedom. Oh, I get freedom, all right. How dearly I would love to have the freedom not to breathe polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, not to have my friends have it in their soil and on their food and in their nostrils and through their eyes and in their mouths. How I would love to have that freedom. How I would love to have that freedom. But we don't, because Nick Adams and all the gun goobers in the United States, too, are worried only about governmental overreach, foreign invasion. This dumbass doesn't even understand what foreign invasion means. Mountaintop removal. Mountaintop removal is funded by foreign banks. Mountaintop removal is funded by Deutsche Bank, by Crédit Agricole in France, by the Royal Bank of Scotland, by banks in Switzerland. And they kill as effectively with their money as if they were over here with guns. Perhaps more so. This is infuriating. This gun garnisher. He closes saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, it is time to replant and reinforce the spirit of individualism, self-reliance, and independence in all areas that made this nation great." And not one part of that statement has a damned thing to do with firearms. And by the way, for all of his lying, he can't get away from the facts. Mark Carlin notes in his editorial at Truthout, "The rate of homicides involving firearms per 100,000 population in 2009 was 0.1, one-tenth of 1%, as compared with 3.3 full percentage points in the United States." Anybody want to do the math on what that's multiplied by? Mark Carlin writes very pointedly and poignantly, "It won't take long for the Sandy Hook Newtown massacre to be lost from the public cry for gun control, just as have so many blood-soaked gun shootings before it. You could make a list of the victims, just like the names of the soldiers killed in World War II or the Vietnam War in a war memorial. And then you can make a list of the 40,000-some homicides, suicides, and accidents that we accept every year as business as usual. The ones in urban areas barely get a notice, except on the knife and gun club weekend television news." My old friend Mark Carlin is a bit pessimistic. He says, "You can tell already that Obama, particularly given his penchant for walking backwards from his promises, is saying that Americans will have to rise up for gun control to happen, and he's giving it to Joe Biden to handle on top of it." Robert replies from Australia, "Bob, I've not heard of Nick Adams. Sounds like your standard nutcase. People handed in their guns because it was the law, and it was a buyback. I was quite shocked at the time to see how many guns were handed in. I felt somewhat safer afterwards. While guns are present in Australia, it is not a gun culture. You don't need them. I've never needed one. Your average farmer may have a single-shot rifle for pest control, are putting down stock in a drought, but that's about it. Sadly, we do have a shooter's party, now the shooter's and fisher's party. Fortunately, after a mildly popular start in 1992, they are largely forgotten. The wiki on them notes that the Australian Shooters Party contested the 2007 federal elections and received 0.28% of the national vote. Yeah, a little update on Mr. Adams. He belongs to something called Patriot Update. Thanks for patriotting for us, Mr. Australian Adams. The leading news source for the everyday American. In response to the mainstream media's dedication to poor journalism and the liberal agenda, Patriot Update provides timely... no wonder he used... AR-15 garnishing. God, he's probably a nose shunner. Jack in Shreveport says, I kind of flipped around the notion you had about there being nothing new to be said on the gun issue. I could state it as, how long will we keep repeating the same nonsense? I think that the U.S. Senate was supposed to provide an institutional memory for our country and our press. If it were to act responsibly, would keep relevant history out of the public sphere as well. Obviously, neither have done those jobs at all in recent decades. What I think may be the cause of the burnout experienced by many liberals is the constant revisiting of the same issues over and over with absolutely no progress at all. I think I personally experienced this during the Republican primary debates, what we call the pageants, where the same misinformation was doled out repeatedly over a period of months, with absolutely no pushback by the press or the debate moderators. Although the above two paragraphs are general in nature, I have just read another letter to the editor, which I saw online on the gun issue. The misinformation and propaganda that the writer repeats is either pathetic or frightening, or both. I appreciate Jack sending these along because, well... It's nice to look into the heart of the crazy sometimes. This again coming from the Shreveport Times. The Shreveport Times titles this letter, Naive to Blame Tragedy on Guns. A horrible tragedy! Exclamation point. How could it happen? Question mark. 26 people killed by a crazed, sick individual, neither of which has been proven. This young man who did this thing should have been hospitalized years ago, no proof for that either, but was shielded by his mother. Should we blame the mother? A mother's love is very hard to fault, and for this love she paid the supreme price. It may have been a blessing that she did not get to witness what her son accomplished. So, in other words, Mother Lanza was mercy killed, according to this writer. Those who would blame this terrible deed on guns are naive. They want a simple solution to a complex problem. They would be better informed and more capable of making rational decisions if they researched history. 75 or so years ago, another madman came upon an unsuspecting people. Do I have to tell you where this is going? There's a law that's about to be invoked. Even those with very slight knowledge of history should have heard the name of Hitler. Wait a minute. Hitler. He was the ultimate embodiment of evil. He is responsible for the murder of millions of men, millions of women, and, yes, millions of children, from those still breastfeeding to teens. He wanted to rule the world, but to accomplish this, he had to take total control of his country. Does this sound somewhat familiar? Well, in terms of the history of Adolf Hitler, sort of, maybe. To accomplish this, he had to confiscate the guns of his citizens, which he did. 26 people is a tragedy. Millions is a holocaust, says Abby Worth. I think Abby's middle name is Normal of Shreveport. Danger of the growth of government that would feel they can also take away our freedoms. They will not attempt this so long as the people stay armed. Yeah, because, yeah, a 12-gauge is going to stop a crazed government bent on domination that have really automatic weapons and really armored vehicles and really black helicopters and really tanks and really armored personnel. Yeah, you're going to protect our freedoms, even though, the gun goobers never have. Robert says, "Hi, Bob. I found Nick Adams' website. He's on Fox News. Do you need to know more?" He says, "Go to the site and listen to the voice welcome. I found it sickening. What a suck up." Well, I can't take it to a challenge like that lying down. Probably needs garnishing.
G'day there. Thank you for visiting my site and online office. Enjoy your stay and visit often. God bless you and God bless the United States of America.
And its guns. Too right. Jesus. No, Ray says, you're not sounding like Garrison Keillor. His pathetic ego is bigger than Hartman's. I detest that freak. I think Ray is talking about Garrison Keillor. Texas Betsy noting, I know a lot of other more important moral imperatives than anything Nick Adams is talking about. Heck, I feel safer in Israel than here, and there are armed soldiers everywhere in Israel, but not armed and crazy civilians. Yeah, Israel would be even more of a party spot if they'd let the settlers, but then again, never mind. Let's not go down that road. Let's go to the phones instead. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, it's Richard, and I'm connecting with you through a rather interesting method by way of Jug of Punch, who has me patched into you on a three-way line.
Well, how do you... Wow, that's wild.
Yeah, I couldn't afford to pay the minutes, so, we were just chatting up on the... what do you call that thing? The group.
The chat room?
Yeah, the chat room, and he thought this up, and it's a rather cool solution. I hope he's not paying minutes on it. But, and I had some things to talk with you about, and I forgot what they were. So this is real interesting. I just wanted to tell you, I got so disgusted with corporate computing. I got so fed up with Microsoft Windows that I've decided to go to Linux and build my own machine out of bits and pieces of other people's computers.
Okay.
So that's what I'm in the middle of doing. And I still don't have enough computers.
Well, then soon enough you'll be able to load Skype and you can connect without charge that way.
Yeah, probably. Where this all came from was that my son bought a new machine. And he got a very good deal on it, and it came with Windows 7. And lo and behold, it won't run his printer. So I spent a couple of days trying to set up his printer on the machine and realized that both Microsoft and Canon had decided to let him go hang. In effect, they just dropped their support.
Yeah, it became orphaned. How old was the printer?
I don't know. I think it's new enough that it should be supported. I usually check the connectors on a product like this, so I can tell its age by the nature of the connectors on the outside of the thing. And that's what I've been...
So what, was it a parallel port connector or something?
No. The presence of a parallel port I think, would indicate a computer that was made for, let's say, Windows 98 or Windows ME.
Or Windows for warehouses, 3.11.
Whatever, maybe it's a bit too much to ask for if they're moving to Windows 64-bit version of something, which is how his machine came loaded. So
that may be the problem, the 64-bit, not necessarily the Windows 7 issue, because Windows 8 is coming out now, and ultimately XP that I'm running here is about to be completely orphaned.
When is that going to happen?
Yeah, I don't know, but I know they've got a deal out. If you you can upgrade from XP to Windows 8 for $40 between now and the 31st. So if I happen to have $40 laying around, which I don't, I will, but I won't, if that makes sense.
It does. Well, what does Windows 8 do for you that Windows XP doesn't?
It's basically, I mean, you probably know this better than I do, Richard. It's not so much the operating system, but the system resources. Because everything out there now uses more resources than older computers can provide.
Yes, yes.
So,
The interesting thing about that versus Linux is that even Linux is marching on. And so, on one hand, I have a friend who has invented a whole new system for music notation and is actually publishing stuff using a very scrimpy version of Linux and getting his stuff out there. I've written a book, and I've written it in Microsoft Word. And it all of a sudden, Word decided to repaginate my document. Put new page numbers on my book, you know?
Wow.
And it's like, I have used Word on the job, and, you know, it's had me banging my head into the wall. It seems to have a long history of doing things, all by itself, and it takes you, like, days to extricate what it has done. It's just amazing. A piece of very powerful but very frustrating software. And it did that to me. And,
well, you can always go with something like OpenOffice.
It is a good package. Really.
It's also free.
Yes, it's called LibreOffice, and I think from...
No, I'm talking about OpenOffice.
No, I know what you're saying. OpenOffice has become LibreOffice.
No, I had no idea.
Yeah. It involves... OpenOffice came, in fact, from a corporate background. And there had been one or two corporate takeovers, and there was some issue about whether the license would still be available. So one group took over OpenOffice, changed the name to LibreOffice, and continued working on it. So that's the lineage of what's been happening. But I looked at OpenOffice when it just first came out, version 1, and it was rough around the edges, and I was really impressed with its capabilities and solidity. You know, the opposite of what I'm talking about. Hey, I was going to ask you something. Where are you on your health business?
where millions of Americans are.
Yeah.
Ain't got none.
Yeah.
No coverage, yeah. And no likelihood of having any.
I parallel you with these conditions, by the way, except my organs are in the right place.
Well, it is fun not that. Well, it is fun not being asked backward. I mean, I can only imagine.
Well, it's just ordinary. But this business about, I've mentioned before that I'm a health commissioner in my county.
Right.
If anybody wants to be on the board, anybody listening lives in Contra Costa County, there's a seat open on the Contra Costa Managed Care Commission right now. And, you want to help steer an HMO that doesn't exist to make money? Come on aboard. We also need a doctor. We have a doctor's seat open on the board. And I want a really advanced, very highly nutrition-oriented doctor, somebody who's had a foot in the holistic camp to sit in that seat. In other words, I'm tired of being the only progressive voice on the board. But it's really exciting. This is the first HMO in the whole United States that is government operated. It's a function of Contra Costa County.
And I had an email from you in which you said that it was expanding. that other counties out there are sort of looking at the model that y'all have established?
Yes, yes, yes. This is real exciting. Three other counties not far away have started their own HMOs based on our model. We've been in existence almost 40 years, but they've always kept a low profile so as to avoid pissing off private enterprise. You know, I mean, government, there's a lot of people who get bent out of shape when government starts competing with private enterprise, as you can imagine.
So, yeah, let's see. Government picking winners and losers was
Who said that?
Oh, right wingers all the time. They say it most emphatically though in the renewable energy sector. You know, there were a bunch of right wingers who wanted the wind energy tax credit to go toes pointed ceilingward as a part of the fiscal baloney. But it turns out that that tax credit has been re-extended, you know, for a year. It needs to be re-extended for about 20.
Yeah.
But the government, let's see, they say that about electric car purchase credits. You know, the government's picking winners and losers. You know what, Richard, I know we're off topic now, but we're kind of still on topic. The fact of the matter is, I want our side to have the guts to stand up and say, yes, absolutely. In renewable energy, we are picking winners and losers because hydrocarbons are losers by definition. Hydrocarbons are dirty. Hydrocarbons are finite. Hydrocarbons are literally the death of this planet's ability to support human life. So, yes, we are rather proud to pick the sun that's going to be here for a few more billion years, and the wind which blows every damn day, and the geothermal energy that is just there for the taking on the interior of the earth. Yeah, we're going to pick the winners, because those are natural winners. Those are obvious winners. And you guys go ahead and keep on picking losers, because you're running with a bunch of losers.
Well, maybe what we have to do is simply ignore them and do our thing, you know? They're gonna be bellowing crap like that, you know?
I'm not concerned, Richard, about them bellowing. I'm concerned with them succeeding in their bellowing. I mean, we got one more stinking year of the wind tax credits, which, for all intents and purposes, does very little to advance our continuation into a renewable energy economy.
True.
I mean, the right wingers like to talk about, you know, we need certainty in the industries. Business needs certainty. Well, the one thing that this still relatively fledgling industry needs is a little bit of certainty.
Oh, absolutely.
But nobody's going to build wind farms if there's not a little bit of support for this fledgling industry out there.
That's true. And I have, you know, I can say something nice about that. I've been pondering it. Most, the wind farms that I know of are all, you know, in mountains that I've seen in California. They're on mountain passes. They're, you know, on top of mountain ridges. But there's one that's not far from me that is not.
Really?
Yes. It's on flat land, gently sloping down toward an arm of the bay, in Fairfield County. If you want to look it up, the nearest town is called Rio Vista.
And well, these things are 30 stories tall, and even if you're on flat ground, and there's a lot of them on flat ground out in the center of the United States.
Well, no, these aren't real tall. These are normal height windmills. And there's sheep grazing at the bottom, you know, at the bottom of them.
Are they industrial or are they for personal use?
No, they're industrial. This is a huge farmer, these things, miles and miles of them.
Then they must be, are they tapping offshore winds where they don't have to get up to great height?
This is inland. If you look on a map of this part of California, let's say between the ocean and Sacramento and Stockton, which both cities are well inland, there is a delta. There's a whole network of waterways, and the area that I'm talking about.
Things like the Russian River and...
No, no, Russian River is north of here.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about going east and...
Do you see the limitations on my knowledge of California geography?
Well, all it takes is just look at a map, you know. The geography is interesting. I mean, I'm just talking about the geography because most people don't know the fact that we have a delta, but it's an inland delta, and it's interesting. So I just went through here. We were going to the trolley museum and actually rode a streetcar for a few miles right past some of these windmills, and I've driven through the area. It's not very populated. In fact, it's hardly populated at all. It's real backwoods sort of country. But like I said, there's miles and miles and miles of these ordinary windmills. And I don't know what the land was used for earlier. I don't think it was farming. I think it was like grazing land.
Well, windmills certainly don't, wind turbines certainly don't interfere with that.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think, you know, my theory about alternative energy is that we should use what we've got. You know, let's say they have wind there. Okay, put up windmills. But, you know, I've been places where there had been hydroelectric dams or mill ponds, you know, old water mills. And it's kind of exciting to look at small-scale power production.
Well, sure, and that's what, you know, that's what makes, and I've been talking about the book fairly frequently of late, this little book by Osha Gray Davidson called Clean Break, which talks about the German energy revolution, the Energiewende.
Yeah.
That's what, and there's this passage early in the book where he talks about, you know, shaking his head in sort of wonderment, wondering if this is some sort of energy Potemkin village that he's looking at as he's riding the train between two cities, and he sees nothing but... You know, windmills everywhere, wind turbines, you know, industrial wind turbines, and solar panels on houses. And for an American to see something like that, having been told, no, you can't, you know, it doesn't work, because that's what the coal industry says around here. By the way, there are now more solar jobs than there are coal jobs, and that's a good sign, and that will continue to grow.
I like that.
But, you look out the train, you look out the car, and you see all these wind turbines, and you go, well, damn, they're making it work.
I don't think it's that hard. I think it's really exciting.
But instead, here in West Virginia, we have Skunk Top Mountains that aren't mountains anymore that you can't put a wind turbine on anymore.
Yeah. Well, I interviewed with a company in Livermore, California, a long time ago. The name of the place was U.S. Wind Power. And they're kind of cool. They made windmills, and they put little computers in the base of each windmill. And when I say little computer, I mean an original IBM PC, you know, with an 8088 processor in it. And, you know, the law had just come in that the electric company had to buy your power, you know, whether they wanted to or not.
Well, and that's, you know, that's a big part of it. It's not just that they have to buy your power. What Osha Gray Davidson talks a lot about is the German feed-in tariff, where small producers of electricity get paid at a higher tariff rate than the massive producers do, because then it makes it economically viable.
Yeah, I like that very much. But even, you know, even with just parity, it is nice. And what happened was a bunch of doctors invested in this company, intending for it to be a tax loss. And so everybody got bent out of shape when they started making money. And they had a few of the windmills up in Altamont Pass, which is, you know, Altamont and the Grateful Dead, and there were, you know, I think some people got killed, you know, a long time ago, but that's the area. And, you know, tons of wind, lots of windmills. So I think the company went belly up for some reason, and the guy who ran it was a very, very progressive person. I think he's relocated to Colorado. But, you know, the thing I'm thinking is, I went to college in Connecticut, and you look around Connecticut, there are all these mill ponds that are just sitting there, you know. They were once water mills for one purpose or another, probably running a little factory. And I went to the northwest corner of Montana to a little town called Troy, and there was a pond. They had had hydroelectric power from this pond at some distant time in the past. Hey, it's there, you know.
Yeah.
Patch it up. Maybe you can power, I don't know, 50 homes out of this thing. Maybe not, but I think every little bit helps.
Sure it does. I mean, that's the whole operating theory behind it, isn't it? But if you've got a government that's serious about it, and if you actually ask questions of people who pay bills, you know, remember, the right wing are made up of people that call themselves fiscal conservatives, right, Richard?
Yeah.
So if you say to them, let's take your power bill from $200 a month to $50, aren't the fiscal conservatives going to absolutely just go wild over that?
Well, we would hope they would.
Except they won't.
Yeah, you know, and someday we'll understand why they think the way they do, but that's a whole other topic. You know, I started asking about your health and what your options are, because I'm suffering a little bit in absentia watching you go through this.
Oh, I don't want you to do that.
Well,
I mean, I appreciate the sympathy, but I don't want you to do that. I mean,
there's
nothing to be done.
Well, my system has faults in it, you know. It's not perfect. And one of them is that we have to operate under conventional rate structures. Before I was even a member of this, it must have been over 20 years ago, I needed a sonogram. And I went to the county, and I said, I need a sonogram. What's it going to cost? And I think they said $300. And then I went to my doctor, who was not part of this, and he said, I'll go across the street from his office was this little imaging shop, you know, and they charged me a third of that. It's $100.
Right, that's kind of the deal that I got from the cardiologist. They said, well, you know, the hospital will charge you $5,000. If you just bring us $1,500 cash, look at the money you'll save. And I looked at him and said, you know, $1,500, what, do you think I print it every morning?
Yeah, God. Well, I don't know what to do about this, but, you know, we've talked about this business before where, you know, it's good for me to be a commissioner because I have a habit of walking into the swinging door and getting my nose bloody. If anything screwy is going to happen to anybody, it's going to be to me, which is good. I'm a great guinea pig. So,
you've also got a good attitude.
I hope. So I go to the hospital for some, you know, the ER, right? And I come out, I don't know, you know, 10 hours later, I come home and I get no paperwork, nothing, you know, and then 5 months later, I get a bill and a notice from a collection agency, both at the same time. The hospital was run by the Tenet Corporation at that point. And they had their own collection agency. So, wham, you know, I get a bill, I forget, you know, $28,000, 10 hours in the emergency room. So I call up the health plan, and I say, what's going on? They said, well, they never sent us a bill. And then, you know, so I call up Tenet, and they say, well, you just send the bill. You know, I'm covered. Well, you know, why haven't you done it? So then I call, you know, our billing department a few months later, and I said, by the way, how did that my visit come out, you know, when I was in the hospital? And she said, oh, yeah, we took care of that. We paid them $78. Okay?
Yeah.
I think it was $78 to retire a $28,000 bill. Something is wrong here.
Look, the for-profit healthcare industry is a giant fraud, maybe it's our fault for not talking in those terms, Richard. But it is, it's a giant fraud. One of the biggest dodges is that supposedly you say you've got an 80-20 policy with them. You know, pick one.
Yeah, no.
And let's use $100 as the baseline, so it's easy for the mathematically challenged like me.
And me, yeah.
Well, you've got an 80-20 deal, so that means if you've got a $100 procedure, you owe 20, the insurance company owes 80. But they, in turn, negotiate a deal where they only pay 50. So if you pay 20 of 50, then your copay is actually closer to 40%, the 40-some-odd percent, than it is 20%.
Exactly.
And they never disclose that to you, and that's how that phony baloney dodge runs. Hey, Richard, I hate to do it, but I got to get out of here.
Okay, good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you, and thanks for your kind thoughts. I really appreciate it.
Oh yeah, well, Jesus, I hope this works out for you.
All right, later, Richard.
Yeah, and thank you for Jug of Punch.
Yeah, thanks to Jug of Punch for facilitating the call. You take care.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye.
Richard calling from California. Time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. We are. Close to, but not at, well, not even close. But anyway, we need $120 to finish the fundraising for tonight to keep us on schedule. And it is much appreciated if you can help where you can. And I know that it gets old, the fundraising, but it's the only thing that keeps us going. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen, our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, the hardest-working, bravest people I know, crmw.net. And acheact.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is on the way.